is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
Iran, once upon a time known as Persia. Iran, we come to a moment in time for the future of Iran slash Persia. I welcome Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, who has very big history with Iran once upon a time, the Shah and Persia, but now in his explication identifies a turning point, April 1st, 2024, when the Israeli Air Force fired six standoff weapons and destroyed a consular section of the Iranian embassy in Damascus, also destroyed the commander of the IRGC forces waging war on Israel. And, Gregory, a very good evening to you. Your backstory here is equally of weight. You were in Iran during the revolution of 78-79, and you were a consultant to the Shah. In those days, the Ayatollah, who became all the center of the rage of the people of Iran, was in exile in Paris. And you indicate in your explication that the Soviets were present. How so? What were the Russians doing in Iran in 78-79 before the Shah left for his health?
Well, the Soviets had always been involved in Iran. And of course, you remember the Soviet-British joint military takeover of Iran during World War II. But even before that, the great war for Central Asia, the great game, in fact, between Britain, Iran, and the Russian Empire before the Soviets, saw a lot of Persian lands alienated from Persia or Iran, Armenia, Azerbaijan, much of Central Asia, which had come under the Iranian or the Persian throne at the time, that had all gone. So there's been a long history of Russian and then Soviet interest in Iran. So they had really key people trying to penetrate and destroy the Iranian monarchy. And the man who went on to be the first leader of post-Soviet Azerbaijan was a general who was in the KGB during the Soviet period, and he was leading that operation. He was funding the groups like Mujahideen-e-Khalq and Fedayeen-e-Khalq, who were supporting student movements. They supported the Tudeh Party, the Communist Party of Iran, which had been pivotal in getting people like Mossadegh into the premiership in the early 50s and so on. So the Soviets were there strongly. As it turned out, they underestimated the speed with which the Shah would resign from power or leave power, because they didn't fully understand the dynamics of his health problem, which had been exacerbated by the Shahbanu, the empress, who basically kept the illness or the seriousness of the illness and the type of the illness away from the Shah, swore his doctor to secrecy and the like, and she kept on drugging him to make him less sensitive to the deeds of the day. And basically she talked him into leaving abruptly when he did. And she had already been smuggling out many millions and billions of dollars of currency, artifacts and gold and the like. So but the Shah then died in exile. But the Soviets had not been ready for that collapse at that time, which created a huge vacuum. Yes, there was rioting on the streets when I was there. I saw these student groups, which had a number of charismatic leaders, quite separate from the Mujahideen-e-Khalq and the Fedayeen-e-Khalq, but all working to that same objective. And the Shah made clear to his military and police commanders and intelligence people that no Iranians were to be fired upon in these demonstrations. He would not risk killing Iranian people. Quite the opposite of the New York Times view and the Washington Post view of what was going on at the time, who they blaming the Shah for being an oppressive leader. He was quite the reverse, in fact. But when he left, just in exhaustion and at the insistence of his wife, leaving some of us there, including Ardi Shahzadi, the last Iranian ambassador to the United States, who was his son-in-law, the Shah's son-in-law, who tried to persuade him to reassert his authority, the Shah was exhausted and left. So the Soviets were not ready. There was a vacuum which was created when the students themselves couldn't agree on a government. They put in another leftist leader there, and he lasted very briefly. And then the mullahs took over, largely because Khomeini, as you said, was in exile in first in Iraq and then moved to Paris. But he did an interview with the BBC. And this was a time when most Persian people, Iranian people, thought that the power behind the Shah was always the British. And so when the BBC did an interview with Khomeini, they took this as a sign that Britain had abandoned the Shah and was now supporting Khomeini. So they basically took to the streets to support Khomeini because he was being backed by the British. Khomeini returned from Paris, even though the French had offered to restrain and contain him. Nonetheless, they flew him back to Iran, to Tehran, and he took over. And the Soviets were lost that game, but so too did the West, so too did the Persian people, the Iranian people. So it was a tragic situation. But we've seen these kind of collapses before, bearing in mind that the Shah's government, the peacock throne of the Pahlavis, basically only began in 1925 after a period of, some considerable few decades, 53 years, I think it was, of basically unrest in Iran before the Pahlavis, who was then
the
general, took over.
Let's 46 years later. The backstory is necessary, but to understand 46 years later and the Israeli Air Force attack on the consulate leading to the Iranian provocation of a barrage fired at Israel, leading to Israel making the point with a weapon that was not seen by the Iranians. Where are we now, Gregory, and what you identify as a turning point? The revolution behind us, and the engagement with Jerusalem. What next for Iran? Where's it going?
Well, we've got to say that there's been this 46 years of gradual decline of the so-called revolution. So when the Iranians, who were under the mullahs, have been very, very strident and bombastic about their strength and about their determination, when they were attacked in their sovereign territory of the embassy compound in Damascus on April 1, they vowed retaliation. And now the clerics knew that they could not withstand a full-scale war with Israel, and they saw that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was quite prepared to go to war with Iran. So they made their promise that they would retaliate against Iran for this insult to the Iranian sovereign territory. But they warned the U.S. through the Swiss embassy in Tehran and through other means, I believe, that there was an attack coming at a date certain. They acknowledged the date. We are going to attack on this date. And they then basically said, here are basically the targets we're going after, and this is the date. In other words, please get your people out of the way so that there are no casualties. They staged that counterattack on a couple of Israeli bases. And what we saw, despite the fact that there were some 350 drones, cruise missiles and some ballistic missiles, and then about 300 or so, 350 rockets fired from closer quarters, that there was a comprehensive destruction of that counterattack. Certainly the Israelis knew the time and place where they had to concentrate forces. And even when the attack was imminent, the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei came on air to say, "We have launched the counterattack." In other words, saying to the Israelis, you've got a few hours now to get your air defenses ready. The Israelis were ready. The Brits and the U.S. and their warship-based anti-ballistic missile capabilities, the Jordanians and the Saudis were all ready, and they all played a part in destroying more than 92% of the incoming rockets. In other words, comprehensively destroying and nullifying the attack. Of course, then, the Israelis had to then the bottom line of that was honor was satisfied, and, we can go back now. The Israelis still needed one more attack to have their honor satisfied. So they said that they would launch a counterattack. And what they did, of course, was after that April 13 attack from Iran, on April 19th, Israel attacked a couple of targets in Iran. Now, the Iranians actually never acknowledged that this attack took place, but what happened was some F-35I fighters with long-range glide weapons, which were not detected, struck an air defense site near the Iranian Air Force's F-14 base near Isfahan, and against a facility close to the Iranian nuclear resource at Natanz. So neither attack was detected in advance. The strike against the air defense site, which was a Russian-built S-300 missile system with its radar, which was supposed to be the state-of-the-art sort of situation, was destroyed without the Iranians even knowing and seeing it coming. Same with the attack on the Natanz facility. The bottom line is that although this de-escalated, these two subsequent attacks de-escalated the situation because the Iranians and, to a degree, the Israelis didn't want a full-scale war. But what it demonstrated was that Iran had no capability whatsoever to withstand a major conflict with Israel. Israel's Iron Dome and David Sling air defense systems were capable of taking down most of these attacks. And what was not put to use was the Israeli Arrow 3, a longer range anti-ballistic missile system, which would have been used had Iran used its medium-range ballistic missiles with nuclear weapons, which they have. Now, basically, the Iranians were very careful not to show that they could or would have used the bigger ballistic missiles or nuclear warheads. They didn't want to escalate it. They wanted to make it clear that this was a symbolic retaliation. But the bottom line is, the mullahs have been now demonstrated to be impotent in this conflict. This is not necessarily going to be a signal to the Iranian people, although it's gradually seeping in.
We have 1 minute, Gregory. 1 minute. Go ahead.
So now we're seeing the mullahs as an empty force. Their time has come to an end. They have not been able to build a capability. They will obviously intend to use Hezbollah to have a capability across Iraq, Syria, Lebanon to the Mediterranean. But that's it. They do not support Hamas anymore. The Israelis have told Hamas they can't come into Jordan. And the Qataris are telling Hamas that they have to get out. So they'll go to Turkey.
We're going to turn to the Gaza war next. Gregory Copley, Defense and Foreign Affairs, 1978, 2024. I'm John Batchelor.